Okay, let's start. Let me say that I think that going through this reading has been very interesting for me. I hope also for you. I mean, I've been studying and working with time-space knowledge with the vision for a long time, and I'm always learning something new, and not only in terms of specific insights, let's say, but in terms of the whole orientation of the vision. And that also has to do with the overall, with what else is going on. So right now I'm in the middle of this conference or symposium that Mangalam Research Center has been sponsoring on a school of Buddhist philosophy called the Yogacara School. And there are certain similarities between that school and some of the things that TSK says, also some fundamental differences. And actually, those of you, a couple of you are here who might be coming to the panel discussion that's part of that symposium today, and you may have a chance to hear that from the other side because I'm going to be presenting something there about Yogacara. All of that is just by way of background. It's not really what we're going to talk about today, but the point I wanted to make is that I think we're moving in a direction that really helps clarify how the vision, the time-space knowledge vision, can make a very fundamental shift in our lives, and the nature of that shift, and the sense in which it's not some huge leap we have to make into another way of being. It's a kind of subtle reorientation. And I think most of you know that, because there's always this question. People are always saying, well, I know TSK really is important. It's really valuable, and I learn a lot from it, but I can't quite say what it is that I'm learning or how it's having an impact. And I think we're getting more clear on that in this course. At least I am, and I hope you are, and I hope you find that valuable. So, I want to start
Definitely
today.
highlight that to score that, Jack.
Oh,
And
okay.
Jack, I agree with you.
Okay, good, great. I appreciate that. So let's start. I actually want to start with a sentence from the last page of the reading for today, where Rinpoche writes, we arrive at the nameless and formless, because after all, the title of this chapter is Returning to the Nameless. So the question is, why, one question is, why would we want to do that? And this chapter is about that. But another question is how do we do it? And at the end of the chapter, Rinpoche has this very nice sentence: we arrive at the nameless and formless by opening appearance to space. And that's what we want to really understand. What is it that we're doing when what does it mean to open appearance to space? And of course, I think you could say that everything we've been talking about so far in terms of space and getting a sense of what the TSK vision means by space, or what dynamics of time and space means by space, all of that helps us prepare for this question of how can we open appearance, how can we arrive at the nameless and formless by opening appearance to space. And although I think that's the main question, I want to call your attention to what I think is just a lovely phrase, just I think a sentence above that, where Rinpoche talks about functioning shape and character out of zero. And those of you who are not native English speakers, I want to assure you that's not native English. That's not the way we would say it in English. Using function as a verb in that way is not ordinary English. But that's the beauty of the sentence, I think. You start with zero, and you create shape and character, as a functional reality. I'm not, I don't really want to talk about that. It just, I just think it's a wonderful use of the language. So I wanted to call your attention to it. So, okay. We open appearance to space, and what is space? The kind of very fundamental question, you could say, that we've been looking at. And of course, the common view that we've been challenging, you could say, is that space is nothing at all, and that's why this, and therefore uninteresting. And that's why this course is called Why Nothing Matters, because nothing is not nothing in the sense that we think it's not something, plays into that dichotomy between nothing and something, and that's just the wrong way to approach it. And what we've been doing is looking for the way in which something, that is substance, the what we take to be real, in which that something or substance is nothing but, and I'm using the word nothing there, but I don't mean anything special by it, is nothing but appearance. Substance is appearance, and that is the kind of turning point of an opening to space, of a returning to the nameless by opening appearance to space, because space manifests in the non-substance of what appears, or in the non-substance of substance is probably a better way to say it. Let me stop there for a moment and look at what a comment that Sudabiz made here. So that's very nice. This can sound a little abstract. I mean, my job, I think, is in large measure to make sure it's not abstract, because we're really talking about how we engage our lives. But Sudhi is giving a dimension to that that is very concrete and down to earth, which I think is really nice. By considering the, I'm going to quote her because I think not everybody's online. By considering the field communique, I'm invited to be more understanding of others' differences and not expecting others to automatically understand where I'm coming from. I'll stop there. But yeah, that's definitely an aspect. When we see that reality is not reality, reality is a communique, is the field communique, we don't hold on to it so tightly. And that's a very immediate aspect of what we're looking at. I'm looking at it right now more in terms of how substance is nothing but the appearance of substance.
Merely.
Excuse me, merely?
Merely. Substance is merely.
Right. Instead of nothing but, you're trying to save me from relying too heavily on the word nothing. I appreciate that. Nothing is merely the appearance of substance. We need to be a little careful with the word merely, and maybe also with nothing but, in the sense that we're not making it less real than it is. It's like if you see a picture of a flower and then you think that it's really a flower, and then you come closer and you say, oh, that's merely a picture of a flower, then it's lost its claim to being real. The thing about substance is that it doesn't lose its claim to be real, but what that means is different from what we thought it meant. It has the appearance of being substance, and it doesn't become any less substantial, but we understand what substance is differently. That's basically what we're talking about here. So what Rinpoche is saying here, what the text is saying, is that appearance results through naming and recognition, and we've been exploring that theme for quite a while. And so it is merely, I'll use that word, given that we understand that we're not, It's not a negative word. Merely doesn't mean less than real. It just means real is not what we think. So, appearance arises through naming and recognition, and that means that it is, it stays named, it stays what has been named and recognized. It never gets beyond naming and recognition. It just stays the appearance of what's been named and recognized. And it's named and recognized as substance. So, I think it's important to understand, and I suppose this is pretty clear, but what that means is that if I'm, if I hit my desk, which I'm doing right now, but you're welcome to hit your own desk or hit your head or do whatever you like to do. That substance is not meant, the idea is not that that disappears. It's just that that's how, given the way we've named and recognized things through the field communique, or it's probably better to say, given the way that the field communique names and recognizes, because we're included in that, we're not the ones who are doing the naming and recognizing, in which case, we'd be kind of godlike, and that's not the case. We're given along with everything else. But the field communique names and recognizes, and so these solid things, the chair, the desk, the computer, our bodies, our past history, all of that is given by the field communique. So let's see. Ari asks a question which she says she's passing on from Karen. Karen? Karen? Is this Karen or Karen? Karen, German Karen? Anyway, the question is, am I saying not to place an intrinsic value on what we see? Well, I'm not quite sure what the question is asking. You could say that the word intrinsic here is a good word for naming exactly the opposite of what we're looking at. There's appearance, and appearance has no intrinsic substance. It's just appearance. But I'm not sure what it means to place an intrinsic value. So maybe you can clarify that a little bit. It has the value that it has, and it fits into the particular story that we're enacting, the field communique. So some things are valuable for us, and some things are not valuable for us. And within the story, they have an intrinsic value. But once you understand that the story, the communique, the naming, and the recognition is all a kind of an ongoing process, and we'll look at that process in a minute, then you could say, no, not really an intrinsic value. So when I was saying before that we are not the ones who give names, it reminded me of a passage from the Bible that I always thought was very interesting, which basically just says that God gave Adam the right to name all the animals, and which he did. And that's, I guess I don't want to try to go into that. It would probably take a couple of minutes, but it seems to me, in a sense, if you take the field communique as being reality, then the self gets set up as the one that has the right to name everything there, everything, and name the reality. And that's just exactly the opposite of what we're talking about. It's the field communique which is setting things up in a particular way. So Ari is adds, let's see, by naming something, others may not agree, so my naming can create distance between myself and others. Well, that's right. It's an interesting, that's one interesting dimension, and it is a dimension that I have not been looking at particularly. I don't think the text is focusing on it so much here, but it's absolutely an important element. The field communique is partly it's shared. As human beings, we tend to see things in a certain way. And so you could say everybody agrees on that. So, if I say, look at that mountain over there, you are not going to say, that's not a mountain, that's a river. That's just a stupid example, but the point is that because we share the same language, we share the same kinds of senses, we're going to see the world in the same way in a lot of ways. But each one of us is also going to have our own way of seeing. And that may well be, I think it's inevitably true, you're right, that creates distance between us. And that's one of the consequences of, accepting the field communique. Okay, I want to look at this issue of how we go about, or what happens, I guess you could say, when you do that. We all set up our own worlds. That's really the related to what Ari was saying at the very top of page 24, at the end of the, well, five lines down or so. Actually, the whole that last sentence. We make the field communique into the truth of the way things are, and that's our job. Our job is to insist on the substance or the reality or the truth of the field communique. You could say that that's, we're set up to do that in terms of the communique, but in any event, that's the role we take on. That's the naming of the animals, So Rinpoche writes, it's as though we each had our own philosophy to proclaim, our own dogma to propound, our own undeniable certainties to put in place. Things get set up as having intrinsic substance. So Michael's asking a question, but I see that it's related to page 27, so I'm going to put it off for a little bit. And maybe when we get a little further along, I'll turn to it. Because I want to look for a moment at the second full paragraph on page 24. The one that starts the solid substance. So we've got this world that's been set up as being solid, substantial, real, and so on. And Rinpoche explores the consequences of that in this paragraph. I think it's interesting and important. The solid substance of the world called into existence in this way produces an impoverished knowledge. So, one of the characteristics of the TSK vision is it often points out that by accepting the reality that we ordinarily operate with, and very often it talks in terms of accepting the understanding of space and time and knowledge that come with that, we impoverish ourselves, we impoverish our world. And that's what he's saying here, but he's going to explain it in terms of what we've been discussing. Having named our circumstances and founded the identities that bind us, we leave knowledge little room to operate. So this, I think, does relate to the question that Michael has just asked and what we will be looking at in a minute. I'm still not going to get to the main point of your question, Michael, but I will later. The issue is this. The field communique is a carrier of knowledge, and that's what Rinpoche says later in this chapter. But if we use naming and recognition, labels and so on, to establish a reality, then we lose the knowledge that's inherent in the field communique. We lose the fact that a certain understanding of reality is always being communicated forward by the communique. It's we take up a position within what's being communicated. And that means that we can't connect with the knowing that makes that communication possible. That's the impoverishment. That's the poverty of our view. We live in a world that has been set up by the communique instead of being able to have access to the communique. So we live in this kind of artificial world. That is, it's a world that we call real. It's not actually as real as the communique. And I don't want to say that the communique is itself substantial, but it's got its power, and in particular, it's got its knowledge, and we can't connect to that. All we can connect with is what's been named, what's been put in place. And then kind of as the consolation prize because we've lost touch with our own reality, with the more with the, this more fundamental reality, we get to name the animals. You know, we get to set things up the way they are, the way we think they are. Of course, it's not us as individuals; it's the language, the culture, the society that gets to name everything. But we kind of are, you know, we're the stand-in. So within this little world that we've set up, we're kind of the king, you know, or at least the representative of the king. It's not very satisfying, but it's the best we have. So it's an impoverished world. Okay. We know from such and such a perspective, I'm still reading in that paragraph, and direct our knowledge towards such and such an end. We move at once from insight to our own reactions, obscuring the initial clarity of experience. I may come back to a little of that, but right now I want to focus on the last sentence where he says, such a knowledge obeys its own law of entropy, declining over time as insights fade and memories blur. So, what's being said there, it seems to me, is that, you know, we have access to a fundamental knowing. It shows up in various ways, and the reading has been talking about that. So, you know, there's great art, there's scientific discoveries, there's insight, there's poetry. There are many ways in which a kind of a deeper knowing seems to enter into our society. But what happens in this attitude we adopt in making the communique into something solid is that we lose touch with that. We you know, those moments are kind of special moments in which we connect with the creative impulse that the field communique really represents. But then we lose it because we turn it into something real. And once we've lost it, I think that's why Rinpoche uses the word entropy. It's very interesting. You know, entropy is the kind of steady running down of the universe, right? The everything is getting worse. I mean, it's got a more specific meaning in physics, but that's kind of the general idea. Everything is getting worse. And you know, it's like I think a good image for that is if you see these beautiful flowers and you cut them and you put them in a vase, then for a while they're still beautiful and then they start to fade and decay and die. And that's entropy in a nutshell. And that's really what we're doing. We're cutting off the root. You know, if we leave the flowers where they are, they're beautiful and they stay beautiful. You know, in that image, eventually the flowers die. But you know, if you cut them and sort of make them into your possession, they die very quickly. So that, I think, is the kind of entropy that Rinpoche is discussing. It's a knowledge that invariably declines over time. And there is this notion, he says in this chapter, that we move from insight, which is that first connection, direct immediate connection to the field communique, to reaction, which is where we get set up as the ones who react to what's communicated, we react to it as real. So let me take a moment to point out two different alternatives, if we think about what that means, you know, as a further description, that is, of how we've moved from insight to reaction, or from the field communique to a commitment to the substance or reality of what's communicated. There's a couple of reactions, kind of historically, I think may help us understand what's going on. So one possibility is in a culture in which everybody accepts the reality of what is communicated, everybody agrees this is the substance of reality. And I think that's basically what you find in any traditional culture, in most cultures in world history. Everybody agrees. Now, you know, I'm not talking on the individual, personal level, cultural level. In a traditional society, there's complete agreement on what has substance, on what's been communicated. Everybody shares at a very fundamental level Everybody shares the same communique, not the most fundamental level, which is more like, I'm real, tables and chairs are real. That's just the human level. But there's this cultural level where everybody agrees. And when everybody agrees like that, what happens is that you get a very slow-moving culture, a culture in which it's kind of like falling asleep. Everybody agrees, and so nobody asks any questions. Now, that's a stereotype, obviously, or it's an oversimplification. But I think, it used to be that people would talk about the Middle Ages or the early Middle Ages as the Dark Ages. Nowadays, that term is out of favor. But I think the reason that people used that term is because there was a certain sense that for several centuries, Europe just fell asleep. It just kept doing what it was doing in this very automatic way. And that's a way of talking about being committed to the truth of the field communique at that particular level. I remember reading once that the French anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss, whose work I hardly know, but somewhere he said that in a traditional culture, it's sort of like a culture that's running a computer program. And it just keeps operating the program over and over and over again. That's the sense of a field communique that everybody accepts. Now, the other possibility, which has happened more in our society over the last few hundred years, and I think it's really, when you talk about modern society, this is what you're talking about, is that people stop believing in a shared truth at this cultural level, and it also goes to the religious level. Maybe especially the religious level, so that you get this breakdown, you get conflict. You have the religious wars of the 17th and 18th centuries, and at the same time you get the rise of science. And the whole point of science, really, again, big oversimplifications, but the whole point of science is that you recognize that the truth gets constructed. It's not something that's given to you. You don't buy into what's being communicated as the truth, and you say, I'm going to discover my own truth, and you do that through empiricism. You do that through relying on the senses, essentially. Of course, there would be a deeper question to ask, which has to do with how the senses are set up or what it is that they're actually communicating, and those questions, do get asked to some extent. They're closer to the kinds of questions that we're looking at. But I'm just talking at the level where people say, okay, there's no shared agreement on this fundamental way of seeing the world, and so instead we're going to rely on the senses, we're going to take empiricism, and the result is that you get science. And the reason I wanted to point that out is that in order for science to work, you have to exclude a whole dimension of your experience, which is the dimension of the self and meaning and value, what's then called the subjective dimension, so that you get these very interesting moves that get made in science and in related fields, social science, and so that the what's called the gold standard in scientific studies is the double blind study, right? Where the person who's being tested in a study, I'm thinking about, psychology and that kind of thing, medicine also, the person who's being tested doesn't know what the test is about, and even the person who's running the test doesn't know what the test is about, or at least doesn't know the details of how the test is being applied. The thing that's interesting about that is that methodology, which is very effective for science and is thought of as the best methodology, is based on not knowing. It's based on ignorance. The whole point is not to know what's going on. And it's a very interesting response to the idea that knowledge is self-constructed. And attempting to make sense out of that, or attempting to use it, but in order to do that, you have to know less in order to know more. And I think there's a certain clue there that something may be wrong. It's like the saying, "Justice is blind." It's like you have to blind yourself to certain things that you know It's like taking the field communique and saying, well, it's just subjective. There is no underlying truth. The reason I hesitate there is because, in effect, what's being communicated is that the truth of what's true is that only that it's all relative and all subjective, but that's still the field communique. We're still accepting it, just not in terms of having a particular content. Sudaba asks, and I am going to get back up to these questions. Sudaba says, so it's blinding ourselves from our prejudices. Yeah, exactly. The point that science recognizes very well is that a lot of the things that we, a lot of what we take to be true is just a result of the particular ways we have or have been taught to name and label experience. And since that's just subjective, since that's what we understand, then you've got to do something to shield yourself from knowledge. And, and what you deny, of course, is any possibility of arriving at a different knowledge. And Rinpoche says, we recognize that something is missing. And so on page 25, at the top of the page, he talks about, we try to compensate for that by looking to the great philosophers, looking to the genius, looking to the artist. We realize that we don't have any access to knowledge, but somehow, for some reason, there are these great creative people who do, and we count on them, because we've lost the possibility of a knowledge that isn't limited in this, in this substance-centered way, this impoverished knowledge that Rinpoche was talking about and that we looked at earlier. So instead of that impoverished knowledge, we are interested in getting back to the knowledge that really fuels or drives or finds expression in the field communique. What Rinpoche says on page 24, and I mentioned this in the orientation, is when we are bound to the specifics of appearance, we lose sight of the indeterminate aliveness of the field communique, and we would like to return to that indeterminate aliveness, which is also a kind of an unbounded knowing, the potential for knowing that you find in the field communique. It's not a big shift in a sense, because the field communique itself is available, no problem. It's the attitude we take towards it, as something that kind of is thrust upon us as the way things are. That's where the problem comes. That's when we find ourselves with an impoverished knowledge which automatically decays because we've lost touch with the aliveness of it. So what we need to understand is pretty simple. At least pretty simple to say once, we've spent a long time kind of setting things up so that it's pretty simple to say. So now that we've done that, it's pretty simple to say. The limits that we place through enacting substance, through insisting on substance instead of appearance, are themselves constructs of knowledge. And that's what Rinpoche says on page 26, about 10 lines down. He says, when we adopt a specific identity, we inevitably adopt its boundaries and limits as well. But like the identities we affirm, these limits are constructs of knowledge. They cannot limit knowledge itself. And that's the possibility for knowing within appearance and knowledge within space. What appears, what presents itself, is nothing at all in relation to the claim of substance. It's not substantial. And knowing that, recognizing that it's a construct of knowledge, and that knowledge manifests as the field communique, means that we can reconnect with that knowledge by connecting with the field communique. That's it. That's simple, right? So at the bottom of page 26, Rinpoche starts to explore what that means. He says, once we see that the ongoing communique invariably presents the whole of time and space as the character of present reality, we can play with this reality however we wish. It's that playful quality. And you know, in a moment I want to consider, and I have to stop right on time today, so we only have a couple of minutes, but it's the playful quality answers the question that naturally comes up, which is, how can we do this? How can we shift our relationship to the field communique? Right? And one answer is by taking a playful approach to what manifests or appears. And a lot of the exercises we've been looking at in various ways are playful approaches. At least that's how I've tried to present them, and maybe now it's clear, you know, why that's so. They're playful approaches to what appears. So maybe you could put it this way, and this is a little complicated for the amount of time we have, but you know, I asked the question, I mean, the name of this course is Why Nothing Matters. And I said at the beginning that there's a certain play on words there, and we've mostly focused on the obvious meaning of that, I think, which is that what we call nothing, which is space, which is you know, the indeterminate quality of what appears, that really matters, because if we connect with it, we discover a different kind of knowledge. Now I want to look at the other side of what might be meant, which is to say that nothing matters, that is, nothing does the mattering. So you start off with nothing, you know, you start off with an indeterminate set of possibilities, which then manifest as the field communique, and or manifest or get communicated forward. I mean, you want to keep it kind of very open, what I'm saying here. They get communicated forward as the field communique, which is then interpreted as matter. You know, it appears as matter. And the question, I'm saying, you could ask the question, well, why does nothing matter? Why does it do that? Why does it manifest as the field communique? And you could say that it does that so that, you know, given the fact that we start off as selves, you know, we show up in this in a particular way, the field communique is a place for us to take a stand. You know, a certain reality manifests so that the self can show up as the one who, you know, who gets to name everything, who gets to own everything, who gets to appreciate everything. That's why nothing matters. That's why the field communique sets up in that way. That's a particular way of looking at that. Now, let me look back at these couple of questions that I kind of skipped over. So Michael is on page 27, and we are too. Let's just look at his question. So he's quoting from the book, if substance arises through naming, the knowledge that makes naming possible must be directly available within appearance. And that is the point that we've been making. That's why I wanted to put off his question until now. And then he asks the question, well, what's the difference between appearance and the field communique? Are both the carriers of naming? You know, appearance and the field communique are very, very closely connected. I think that the communique establishes appearance, which then claims to be substance. So when appearance stays appearance, it takes us back to the field communique. You know, appearance can either sort of harden or congeal, you could say, into substance, or it can stay open as the field communique. And you ask, are both of them the carriers of naming? I don't think I'd quite say it that way, but it doesn't matter so much how you put those words together. We're trying to name something that's pretty slippery and hard to name. Maybe not so hard to connect with, but pretty slippery and hard to name. So, if you find that a useful way, or maybe you're saying you don't find it a useful way, either way, I think kind of works. Were you going to say something?
Thanks.
Yeah, just thanks, thanks.
No.
Okay. And then Sudaba asks the question, does this connect to the idea of not knowing? So the field communique could stay operating and allowed to shift from moment to moment. I'm paraphrasing. The answer is yes. That, a not knowing or not knowing is a way of staying open and being playful with what's communicated forward. So that's another approach to very much the same point. Something I was reading recently, I can't remember if it was in one of the TSK books, but somewhere Rinpoche says that, if not knowing seems like too big a jump, you could just say, well, leave room for the possibility of not being certain, not being sure that this is the way things are. That's a very good starting point. So you might think about it that way. Okay, just one more point. I said being playful, that's the way to connect back up with the knowledge that's in the field communique. I want to point you to an exercise you could look at during the next week, which really allows for the possibility of engaging appearance in this way. It focuses on space. In the end, you could focus through time, you could focus through space, you could focus through knowledge. I think what we've been discussing, even though it's in the space section of Dynamics of Time and Space, is also very closely related to knowledge. But take a look at exercise 7 in Dynamics of Time and Space. It starts at page 271, and that would be a good way to kind of playfully engage what appears. And in particular, although the whole exercise is certainly a good way to do this, in particular at the bottom of page 272, let me read you that. At the bottom of page 272, he gives a kind of variant. He says you can also experiment with seeing the object, so whatever object it is you're looking at, from several perspectives at once, or with maintaining an awareness of space at several different levels of magnitude simultaneously. Well, those are just two ways of being playful, but you might want to experiment with those. And see where they take you. So we'll stop there for today.